Please join in singing hymn number 12, O Life That Maketh All Things New, hymn number 12. If you need a hymnal, check your email newsletter for information on how to get one.
Good morning. Our opening words this morning are by John Saxon. Listen, can you hear it? The Spirit is calling. It calls us in the silence and through the noise and the busyness of our daily lives. It calls us in the brightness of the day and the darkness of the night, in times of hope and despair. Listen, can you hear it? The Spirit is calling. It doesn't matter what you call it, if it has no name or many different names. The Spirit of life, the Spirit of love, the Spirit of compassion, the Spirit of hope, the Spirit of justice. Listen, can you hear it? The Spirit is calling. It's calling to you and to me. It's calling us to greater wholeness, greater connection, greater service, greater love. It's calling us to heal the brokenness within ourselves, in others, and in the world. It's calling us to live more deeply. It's calling us to beauty. It's calling us to love and laugh and dance and sing. It's calling us to live through life's pain and sorrow. It's calling us to live courageously and kindly, to speak truth in love, and to bend the moral arc of the universe toward justice. It's calling us into community. It's calling us into the greater life of all. Listen. Can you hear it? The Spirit is calling. I've been reading this week about the Salem witch trials, about the story of the women and the girls falsely accused and tragically subsequently killed. And no, this is not my version of light summer reading. It's a book that I picked up while visiting Salem last summer and it's been waiting on my bookshelf ever since. And I'm reading it now because world events have left me wondering, when do we leave the point of logic and go straight to conspiracy theories? Frustratingly, this book doesn't actually answer that question. But what it does talk about, and what feels relevant here, is the lives of the young girls and women in question, those eventually accused and persecuted and prosecuted as witches. What I hadn't fully understood is that these children, these female children, which is worth noting here, they were living in a very sort of specific Puritan time and culture. These children, they worked from a very young age. They were bound by rules so strict that even joy and laughter were forbidden. And given their upbringing, they feared nothing more than the devil. These children were terrified of darn near everything, of hunger, of their parents, of death, and of failing God and thus earning eternal damnation. And add to that challenge also being a girl, so thus being allowed none of the athletic or other outlets afforded young boys of that time. And those constraints must have been unimaginable by our standards today. And so the girls thus had two choices. They either found their own secret outlets, ways to let go of some of this accumulated pressure in each other's presence, or they could wait to kind of literally combust from the relentless nature of the world in which they lived. And so, as one does when circumstances feel unbearable, these young girls turn to more creative endeavors, to imaginings, to stories and possibilities outside of the harsh realities of their actual lives. And these actions, these simple actions and imaginings, were so unexpected in that place and that time that it got interpreted as evil and as possessed. And that's the nugget, the core of the circumstance that eventually got these young girls labeled witches. You can call it now trauma or PTSD or survival, but this is what we do when we can't control what's happening around us. We begin to shift our perception of it. So the label of witch was applied to these young girls and women because their actions were outside of the expected norm of acceptable behavior, so to speak. And yes, there are stories of possessions and more which led to the fear and persecution, but all of this is also readily explainable by the pressures of the environment in which they found themselves. And so then as now, when external pressures become difficult to bear, we find ways, conscious or not, to release, to exhale, to let our fears and worries not run our lives. And so, well, I get that this example, young girls accused of witchcraft, it might sound like an extreme example to some, but in truth, it isn't far at all from the realities of our time. Many groups are being marginalized and persecuted in just this way. Immigrants, transgender individuals, women, and more. The powers in charge are going after all these groups so voraciously that it is unquestionable that anyone subject to that persecution, you can be sure that their spirit is absorbing some of that impact. And even the rest of us living comfortable lives, just being alive and aware in this moment, there's such a surprisingly high level of societal stress that it's hard to escape and hard to manage at times. So I've been asking myself and you, what are the outlets, the ways we take a big collective breath and then exhale together, seeking to find respite from the seemingly unending onslaught of fear and anxiety? You know, and I wonder, are your friends and family sustaining you? Are you using distraction? And that's not a criticism, but a valid coping mechanism. Are you using distraction to turn away from the news? Are you so busy parenting or working or both that you're kind of just mentally turning away from the stress of the moment? Or are you throwing yourself into action and activism, needing to do something and knowing too that your actions are helping? Some of us are leaning on each other, as well as on practices of regular community contact, to support us during these times. But I want more for us as we navigate these unfamiliar waters. How do we recognize the particular stresses of this time, of a society willing, wanting to punish those who diverge from its mandates? What will help us not only survive, but thrive right now? I've been reading a lot about the so-called Spanish flu, the influenza of 1918. I was hoping to find answers and maybe even some direction. And it's fascinating reading, I'll admit, because it has a lot of the same arguments and needs about shuttering faith communities and schools, similar resistance by some to the wearing of masks, and the same, of course, desire to return to the normal that had previously existed, and that, of course, resulting in a second wave of illness and death that actually far outstripped the first. The challenges then and now are really not so far apart. As I kept reading, I found that the communities, and especially the faith communities who thrived best a century ago during that pandemic, they did so by diverting resources from those with more to those with less, by committing themselves to doing things like sewing and knitting and building for those in need. In a nutshell, by focusing their attention outward on the larger community. And some of it, this of course, is goodwill. But it's also a way, then as now, to keep the restlessness and the loneliness at bay. I suspect that there was motivation, then as now, to create that good feeling that one gets when doing work with and for others. But was there more, I wondered? You know, how did the faith communities sustain themselves? How did those communities continue, and how did they take care of their people in an era so long before email and Zoom and the like? And it turns out that the focus became, not unexpectedly, the deepening of one's spiritual life. For many communities of that time, that meant Bible study. The faith leadership would send out specific passages. They would write them and leave them or post them in the town square or share it by word of mouth. And they indicated the scriptural passage to be pondered, read, and discussed within the family for that period of time. And I wondered, why have we not been doing this? And we wouldn't, of course, engage in the fire and brimstone of the Puritan model, but with the far gentler approach of Unitarian Universalism, the sort of spiritual work that offers a chance to be together in exploration even when we're not physically together. I'm wondering, fellow travelers, fellow explorers, can we try this method and can we see how it works? So here's a passage I offer for your consideration this week. I encourage you to think about it, reflect on it, and even talk with family and friends about it. The passage I've picked is from Amos, and this is one of the most quoted prophets in Judeo-Christian scripture. And it was one of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's favorites. It's also a super brief passage. Here's what it says. But let justice roll down as waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream. I'm going to say it again. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness as a mighty stream. Yes, I'm asking us to do some faith homework this week. Go read about that passage. It's a game changer. It asks us to live differently And even more spectacularly, in my opinion, it offers direction. I love this possibility because we can be in reflection and learning together even when we are physically distant. And I know, as Unitarian Universalists, that so much is available, that scripture is literally everywhere, in the trees and the birds and in each other, and not just in a book. I'm just asking you to try this with me this week. Let us explore together how our spirits might be sustained in this time, and in doing so, how we might find a path forward together, a way to deepen our ties even from a distance. I thank you for your spirit of adventure, and I hope you find this a fruitful time spent in reflection. Blessed be. Our closing words this morning are by Margaret Cape. As surely as we belong to this universe, we belong together. We join here to transcend the isolated self, to reconnect, to know ourselves to be at home, here on Earth, under the stars, linked with each other. Please join me in our closing song.
The flame of peace and love until we meet again. Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again. Carry the flame of peace and love until we meet again.